want to do the other large movement that's been associated with Eastern Europe, the Haskalah, from the Blackboard. The other word in any Haskalah, Maskilim, are the men of the Haskalah, those adherents of Haskalah, called Maskilim. I think it'd be worthwhile to start off with the word itself, exactly what does it mean, what does it entail. Those of you who know a little bit of Hebrew or a little bit of Yiddish will notice the root of both Haskalah and Maskilim being Seidel. I guess someone knows the word. Common sense, logic, reason. And as you can tell, it's the whole movement deals with such concepts, common sense, reason, logic. And again, we are involved with the concept of Talmud and movement against Talmudists. We are concerned with an attempt to move away from Orthodox Jewish texts as far as sources for study of Judaism. The Haskalah itself, the word Haskalah, is usually also associated with such things as higher education. And part of the policy of the Maskilim, the men of the Haskalah, becomes associated with education, educate the Jews, but not to educate them in traditional patterns, the Talmudic pattern, but also through secular subjects. So introduce the study of languages, mathematics, science, into Haskalah. Now, the term it's becoming an all-encompassing thing. In Jewish historiography, people start writing about the Haskalah, start someplace then in the 18th century, continues throughout the entire 19th century, people even put Zionism onto Haskalah. This is legitimate, because what we're doing now is dealing with a type of Jewish thought that, again, does not focus on traditional Jewish scholarship, Talmudic. And Zionism as itself also moves away. The original Maskilim were interested in Talmudic plus something else. And as you'll see through the course of the lecture, I hope this moves away gradually and gradually. So I think it's fair to say when we talk about Zionism later on, Zionism comes as some sort of stepchild to the Haskalah movement. It begins with this secularization of Jewish studies, secularization of the concept of Jew in Eastern Europe in this respect. Again, I want to recall to your minds the dominant system of thought at the time, the idea of Talmudics, which had not been shaken up by the Hasidic movement. Remember, Hasidism itself did not posit a different system of study. Hasidism was more of this revolt against the social stratification and the study of the Talmud and what this meant being a Jew of the Talmud. It wasn't that it replaced the Talmud with anything else. Also, as you recall, by the 1820s, Hasidism also had returned to the fold in its stress on study of the Talmud and had moved back into Talmudic study. Now, the question that concerns the first, what is the source of Haskalah in Eastern Europe? Because if you recall, we have these roughly 2 million Jews of Eastern Europe who are cut off from Western thought. When we talk about intellectual currents, the Jews in Germany, we talk about Mendelssohn and Geiger, some of these people in Germany, they are in a place where you have such things as enlightenment. You have the impact of Western thought on Jewish communities, especially the Berlin community, where there is no ghetto, where there are freer associationships. But in the East, we have these Jews who are cut off. They're in this large ghetto, this tail of settlement. And so the question is, where do they turn? How does Haskalah enter into their lives? And we look for two real sources, internal and external, from Jewish life itself and from the outside. Internally, you recall talking last week about Hasidism, I started mentioning that there's a movement of opposition to Hasidism. There's a Hebrew word for it which just means the opposition to Hasidism. And I guess by just looking at the word itself, you can see how great the impact of Hasidism is if the movement against it has to define itself in negative terms. That is the opposition. But in any case, the opposition is associated with one of the most brilliant Jewish Talmudical scholars of the 18th century in the city of Vilna called Rabbi Elijah. He's given his term name of the Gaon, he's the great scholar, because of his great abilities to swallow knowledge, literally. In Talmudic thought, in Talmudic educational system, you study the Talmud first, you study Jewish scripture and Jewish commentaries first, and after you've exhausted all that, Then, if you still have time in your life, you can move over to secular subjects. You can start studying languages and start studying sciences. Well, within this system, Elijah mastered 10 languages. Elijah had already moved into geometry and calculus. He's reputed to have known the entire Talmud by heart. He's one of these outstanding minds. But at the same time, he is an aristocrat as far as a rabbi is concerned. And he is firmly opposed to Hasidism. He's excommunicating the Hasidim in Lithuania. And I recall it doesn't have difficulty for Hasidism in Lithuania. But at the same time, he realizes there's something wrong with the system, with the educational system. And he himself, being a learned man in more than one area, the Talmudic area, begins to relax some of the boundaries for study. And so during the time of Rabbi Elijah's, his days is 1720 to 1797. You see, he comes into that period just at the end when Hasidism has made its greatest leap forward. But so Elijah relaxed some of these restrictions against outside study, and in this late 1780s, there's a Hebrew translation of Euclid, Euclid's Geometry, published in Lithuania. It has gotten to the point where things are tolerated. Outside sources of knowledge are tolerated. Elijah goes even further, and if you recall last week I was describing the system of thought where you invent contradictions, looking for contradictions, trying to resolve them. Elijah goes further, and he denounces this type of study, and he says that we shouldn't worry about these hair-splitting systems, rather we should study the Talmud and study the Talmud as it is there. Now, one of the problems is that the Talmud is written in different languages, so Elijah agrees that you can study outside languages. And given this impetus, a group of men in Lithuania, in Vilna especially, who start moving into secular subjects. Now, this doesn't mean they're abandoning Orthodoxy, but they're studying Orthodoxy with the help of outside sources, most particularly studying of grammar. They're in the Talmud itself, in the composition of this. This is originally done by hand. There are sometimes mistakes. The scribe made a mistake in a grammatical construction. If you accept every single word of this as handed down at Sinai, or as being an oral tradition that was handed down at Sinai codified later, then you know you can't have mistakes. You can't start tampering with the grammatical construction. But at this time, there are men who start studying grammar and who start resolving these controversies on the basis of grammar, on the basis of what is Hebrew grammar, and on the assumption that there's a mistake someplace in the transcription of this. But this is a movement that is in Orthodox circles. It is not frowned upon. It is advocated by the leading scholar of the day. This is the internal springs, the Haskalah. Externally, we look at two sources. The first one is Galicia. In Galicia, it's the town of Brody. There's a large Jewish wealthy class, group of merchants. And as we had also in the West, these merchants are at the same time, recall again that Galicia is under the Austrian domination, in the Austrian Empire. Recall also the Edict of Toleration. And in Galicia, there is this movement towards education. The merchants themselves are more influenced by Western thought, are supporting Jewish scholarship, non-heretical scholarship, but Jewish scholarship that is emphasizing reason, rationalism. And there are several great scholars who come out of this tradition, names such as, if you remember them, Krochmal or Pearl or Rappaport. But the point is that these men are doing serious scholarly work within the Orthodox tradition, but at the same time, are not sticking to their original sources. There are, Krochmal himself writes, based upon Maimonides' Guide for the Perplexed, Krochmal writes a very important work called Guide for the Perplexed for our time. Now what happens is that as the internal Russian Empire is opened up, many of these merchants from the city of Brody, some of their descendants, start moving into the southern part of the Russian Empire, most particularly to Odessa. And as they're moving into Odessa, they're bringing with them a German culture. At the same time, this Haskalah type of thought, books by Krochmal. And in this way, Odessa becomes a source or a center for German cultural activity in the south of Russia. Odessa itself was a brand new city in the 19th century. The Russians had just taken Ukraine at the end of the 18th century and had just opened up the port on the Black Sea. So Odessa is a brand new city. It's an international flavor. There are Greeks in Odessa. There are Romanians from Moldavians, really. And there are this Jewish community, not Russian Jews, but Galician Jews who moved into Odessa. The other outside source for Haskalah himself, German Jewry, and most particularly Moses Mendelssohn. The figure of Mendelssohn, who is Orthodox, right? Sorry to mention this, but you can recall the balance of Mendelssohn Orthodoxy, and at the same time living in a secular culture, becomes a very, very impressive figure for men sitting in Vilna who are living in a small ghetto, and here they have this example of a man who lives in these two worlds at the same time. You must realize these early Maskilim are not opposed to Orthodoxy, are only looking for other aspects of Orthodoxy, saying Orthodoxy must not be so rigid. It must also take advantage of other studies. So that Mendelssohn himself, as a personality, as his lifestyle, the balance that he has set up, this type of thing, becomes very influential. Not that it was studied so closely, but just this vision far off in Berlin. Before the time of Palagigon, Jews from Vilna, from Lithuania, who wanted to study, would always head for Berlin, just as Mendelssohn himself had gone to Berlin. Mendelssohn was not born in Berlin, had gone to Berlin to study. An example of this, those of you who are reading Family Moscow come across Asa Heschel Panet. Asa Heschel Panet is a representative figure of a type of Jew who has abandoned everything and gone off to study. And a man who this is most particularly modeled on, Solomon Maimon, who leaves Lithuania, goes to Germany, studies Kantian philosophy. He's a wife at home, family. He's on the verge of conversion, never does convert, and passes away a very almost dissolute, impoverished, cynical type of person. And this becomes a model for the Jewish maskil. The maskil who has moved out of the tradition, who has gone away, but this is all before. The second thing, coming from Berlin, over the years 1780, roughly 1811, the descendants of Mendelssohn, the intellectual descendants of Mendelssohn, started publishing a Hebrew periodical called The Collector. The Collector, this periodical, emphasized these ideas of some way to harmonize Judaism and rationalism, to spread education, secular education, to study language, especially the language of the country that you're living in. And this also was brought into Russia, into Lithuania, was read, was absorbed, and was had a profound impact on the young people in Lithuania, in the Russian Empire. So then we have what I think are these three different sources, the internal, external, and the external divided into two. One source coming from Galicia, one source coming from Berlin itself. This type of Haskalah devoted to studying Orthodox Jewry, studying the Talmud, but also studying other aspects of life, continues for approximately 1820s, early 1820s. At this time, the split, the rift between the opposition and the Hasidism and Hasidic movement have gotten together. The rift is the Hasidim are no longer moving out, conquering new fields. The opposition, from the north and Lithuania are not coming and trying to reconquer, or they've reached some sort of accord. Also at the same time, the great threat to the rabbis, the idea of the Hasidim giving up on the Talmud, not looking to the Talmud, has passed. The Hasidim have come back into the fold, have now moved into a study of the Talmud. So, who is the two of them coming together? Now the outgroup are these Maskilim, because at the same time, the Maskilim have been moving a little bit further and further away. The more they're studying secular culture, the more they become absorbed in secular culture. What happens initially is that they start changing their dress, some of them. Some of them cut off their side locks. Soon they're being dubbed Berliners by the other Jews. And these men were so under the influence of the Berlin Jews that they started to look like Berlin Jews. And so we get a period roughly in the 1820s when Haskalah is beginning to be cut off. One of the reasons, another reason for this thing is that the series of conversions in the West. Whereas before, you know, if you say, yes, you can study secular languages, but then you take a look in the West, and there are Jews who are contemplating conversion, there are Jews who have begun proceedings to convert. So you think, well, what is the use of this? We're losing, you know, the Jewish people. And this is also indicated that in an event when Napoleon has invaded Russia, he appealed to Jewish help against the Russians, right? Pointing to all these edicts against the Jews. And the Hasidim on the path leading, for the point going into Russia, the Hasidim on that path supported the Russians against the French. And they explained it very simply that with the French, you get assimilation, at least with the Russians, we stay together. So the fear for the Orthodox circles, the fear for these people, now became these conversions, now became excessive secularization. Not studying of a language towards harmonizing sources, but excessive secularization. So in the 1820s, we get Haskalah moving to a different path. And the representative figure is this man, Isaac B. Levinson. Levinson, by some people, is called the Mendelssohn of Russia. Because he's really the first first man to really part of the tradition so much. And I wanted to say a few words about Levinson. He's born in Podolia, and if you recall, Podolia is the home of the Besh, Hasidism. So he's born in a very, very Hasidic and a very unenlightened, and let's put quotes around unenlightened, neighborhood, area. He goes off to Galicia, where he meets people such as Prokhorov. He studies in Galicia. He's influenced by the Galician Haskalah, by the movement from Galicia. And then he returns to Russia. And he returns to Russia, and in the late 1820s, he writes one of his more famous works, the Instruction in Israel, it's called. Instruction in Israel. Where he presents a four-point program, actually. And defending his type of study, the new Haskalah, the new movement. He says, first of all, that the study of the Bible and study of Hebrew grammar is not contrary to Orthodox tradition. That it's completely in line with Orthodox. Of course, he can point to the Elijah Gaon himself, who studied this book. He says that Judaism is not condemned with the knowledge of foreign languages. Points to many Jews, and becomes a joke among Maskilim. They say, when David was wooing Bathsheba, they speak to her in Yiddish. In other words, saying whatever Jews were at whatever time, they always spoke the language which they were living in. So why should all these Jews in Russia speak Yiddish? Either they should speak Russian, or they should speak Polish if they're in the Polish sector, or some sort of Lithuanian. But why Yiddish? So he makes this argument. For speaking the language of the country you're in. And then he moves on to the sciences and points to examples of Orthodox Jews, prominent Jews, who knew science. And the most obvious example, of course, is Maimonides, the doctor, the colleague of Egypt. But then he moves into another area. Haskalah is now, by the 1820s, no longer satisfied with thought. It's moving into economic and social areas also. And Levinson says that in order to regenerate the Jewish community of Russia, we must change the economic and social way of life. He, again, what we call Gaon, talks about making them farmers, making them artisans. They must give up commerce. They have to move into a new type of life. As far as social way of life, says that Jews should not be married at early ages. Recall these population figures, this large, bulging Jewish population. Well, Jews were being married at the ages of 15 and 16 at this time. Jews would marry at an early age, would move in, a male would move into his father-in-law's home, would be financed by the family, and later, after he's finished studying, he would move out. Levinson is saying this is detrimental to the Jewish community. These early marriages, people cannot support themselves. Then when they finally do finish this period of study, what do they have? They're just another Talmudic scholar. Now, how great a scholar it is, you know, it is never certain, but they're just another scholar. And he says, so at the same time, it's not marrying young, you should also move into different handicrafts, different ways of life. This book, of course, is condemned by the rabbis, condemned by the Hasidim. Levinson approached the government with the book. The government, of course, found the book very, very interesting. Levinson then writes another book called The House of Judah. This is at the end. Now, you must recall when this is going on. This is roughly 1828, 1829, 1830. The same time, the government of Nicholas I is conscripting Jewish boys at the age of 12, taking them into the armed services, into the army, until the age of 25, when then they start serving their regular service. This is also the time in Russian Jewish history when in order to get boys into the army, there are these kidnappers. I mean, they're Jewish kidnappers and there are non-Jewish kidnappers, but each little community has a quota still, so there are boys being depressed into service against their will. Many, many times, these people, of course, coming from the poorest sections of the city, of the town. So here, Levinson is writing this thing and is approaching the government, looking for the government to act as some sort of enlightened absolutism, which will help the Muscovite, help the enlighteners to enlighten Jewish people of Russia to change their patterns of life. In his book, House of Judah, he begins with a tracing of Jewish history, a tracing of Jewish philosophy, and to defend it, because Judaism is coming under attack by the government of Nicholas I, to defend it. And then he moves into the areas where he thinks the government should help Jews. The first thing he calls upon the government is to open elementary and secondary schools for Jews, saying that the school system, as it's set up now, is one which all you learn is the same things have been taught for 200 years. Different schools. You need a secularized school. He calls for a chief rabbi, the establishment of rabbis in each community, government rabbis. We call the example of France. So he says the same thing. These rabbis who are ordained in Russia have too much power. They run the communities. We need someone who is a government representative. A trained government representative who's also trained as a Jew. Then the next aspect, in going back to this economic program, he calls for tracts of land to be set aside where Jews can become farmers, saying that the Jews are crowded into ghettos of cities, this big whole ghetto anyway, this pale of settlement, because they must be allowed out. Levinson never said anything about emancipation and freedom of movement, but he's saying the tracts should be set aside where Jews could learn the art of farming, become farmers. And with this book, this last book by Levinson, The House of Judah, we have a new relationship being put into progress now, and set up. Because what happens is that, again, the book is put on it's called Heresy by the rabbis. It's not to be circulated, but the government subsidized it. Nicholas I paid some 1,000 rubles to have the book published and then dispersed. The book is very appealing to young Muscovite studying in school, because it's saying all those things, schools that they're interested in, rabbis, not some rabbi whose training is not a long modern line, and finally changing the economic patterns of life by introducing agriculture. Again, with Levinson's book, we have the Muscovite moving further away from traditional Jewry, Orthodox Jewry. Because this spurts on the government to move into these areas that Levinson has suggested. You recall in the 1835 Charter of Disabilities, we mentioned that in relation to setting up the Pale Settlement. But there are other aspects to this Charter of Disabilities of 1835. The first is that there's a dress regulation. It's illegal for a Jew to travel anywhere in the Russian Empire unless he's dressed in Western clothing. If a Jew wants to travel, he has a travel permit, he still must change his attire. He can't travel dressed as wearing a long coat with the hat, the Jewish hat. He must travel as a 19th century man. Another aspect of the Charter of 1835 was the language. The official language in all Jewish government correspondence, the official language in all Jewish government relations must be the local language. Therefore, if they're living in the Polish area, it must be Polish. If they're living in a Russian area, it must be Russian. Hebrew and Yiddish no longer serve as a language of petition. Jews cannot write to a government official in Hebrew and Yiddish and expect that letter to be received. There is a minimum age for marriage set. No girl under 16, no boy under 18. Could be officially married within the Russian Empire. I realize all these things, there are ways of getting around them. ways of getting around it. But just think that these are the advices, these are the propositions put forward by Jews, adopted by the government, and enforced against other Jews. What I'm saying is that there's now a great tension being built up. The tension that was there already is now being further enforced between the Maskilim and the rest of the Jewish community, who may not want to be married at 16 or 18, or who may not want to travel around the West in clothing. But now, because the Maskilim have petitioned the government and suggested these type of reforms, is now law. And while there are ways of getting around this, if you're caught, you're fined. If you're caught, and if you don't have legal papers, you could be sent off to the army for 25 years. And it's, it sets up a greater tension between the secularists and the rest of the body of the Jewish community. Also, another aspect of this 1835 law was that there were tracts of land set off to Siberia for Jewish agriculture. What happened though, after 2 years, that Nicholas felt that the Jews were a bad influence on the Siberian population, so this was canceled. But the point is that the government was willing to go that far to set up Jewish colonization projects. It's not new, because also in the 1804 Charter for Jews was also set up in southern Russia. So if you know a little bit about history of the Trotsky family, you know that Trotsky's father was one of these Jewish colonists. It becomes a theme through the century, setting up tracts of land to have Jews work as farmers. The most important area that the Maskilim were interested in, of course, was education. Now, the Maskilim were very much impressed by a school set up in Odessa in 1826. Again, recall the residents of Odessa are Galician Jews for the most part. In 1826, they had set up a school, a Jewish school, which all the teachers were Jewish, but which also taught secular subjects. The language of instruction was German. The mathematics was taught. Language in German was taught. I think history was taught. And then Hebrew was taught, and religion. And the Maskilim were very impressed. And they didn't take into account that this is a separate Jewish community in Odessa that was really quite different from the other Jewish communities in Russia. But they said this type of thing should be extended to the rest of Russia. In 1840, a similar type of school was set up in Riga. Riga is also a city with a very, very large German Jewish population, not a Slavic Jewish population, but German Jewish population. In the 1804, again, the idea of education, in the 1804, Charter for Jews will have been invited to attend Russian schools. Jews have been invited to attend Russian schools. Not many Jews went, of course. I have some numbers. By 1840, out of 80,000 pupils in primary and secondary schools in Russia, only 48 of them were Jewish. Out of 80,000, 48 Jews. On university level, it's a bit higher. There were 15 Jews out of 2,900. In 1841, the government of Nicholas I decided that the only way to modernize the Jews was through an educational system. And what they did was they called in a committee of Jews to discuss what type of educational system should be set up. And by 1844, a system was set up called the Crown School, the Jewish Crown School System. What had happened was that the primary and secondary schools were set up specifically for Jews. This is because of these numbers. Jews did not attend the Russian school system set up in 1804, so they had a separate school system which was financed by the Jews. Money for the system came out of Jewish taxes, specific Jewish taxes. And it was set up in 1844. The moving light behind the school system was another one of the Maskilim, not a Russian, but a German Jewish Maskil, a man named Max Lilienthal. Lilienthal himself was principal of the Riga Jewish school. And the Russian administration was very impressed by him. He was 22 years old at this time. Very impressed by him, wanted him to hit the whole system. He went on a tour of the Pale Settlement, trying to convince Jewish leaders that this new school system would be the right answer towards modernizing Russian Jewry. And once Russian Jewry modernized, of course, then there was emancipation working in the future. The Russian government would not emancipate until they were modern, until they were educated. Lilienthal made his tour, he came back, the system was set up, but within the first year, Lilienthal left. He eventually wound up in the United States as a rabbi. But in 1844, the school system is set up. In addition to these schools in every large city, primary school and a secondary school, the schools were set up such that secular subjects were taught, and religion taught in the schools would be Judaism, and Hebrew would be taught. Now, it would be a Jew who would teach religion and Judaism, and all the other teachers would be Christians. William Thaw had proposed that teachers be brought in from Germany to staff the entire school system, but the government decided it would be better off to have Christian teachers, because they said there would be no disharmony to teach secular subjects, doesn't matter who the teacher is, as long as the teacher for religion, the teacher for the Hebrew language would be Jewish. But William Thaw leads and the schools are set up. An additional aspect of the education reform of 44 was that there were two rabbinical seminaries set up in 1844. The purpose of the seminaries was to train rabbis to become an official crown rabbi. In other words, he is an employee of the government. He would be sent to every locality, in every city, and he would be the official rabbi. No rabbinical paper could come out of that locality without that rabbi's signature on it, no decree. No rabbinical order could come out without that rabbi's signature on it. The rabbis were trained in these seminaries, the same on the seminaries to train teachers to move into the school system also. It's all set up in 1844. Another aspect of this reform in 44 was that the traditional Jewish teacher who had been teaching all along, a timetable was set up so that by the 1870s, any teacher who was teaching it, because the Crown School did not eliminate any other school system, it just that it gave an alternative to those people who wanted to study secular subjects. But so the traditional teacher by the 1870s would have to be a licensed teacher. Up till now, the Jewish teacher, in the cheder, the Talmud Torah was not licensed. He was supported by the community. So it was set up through this reform of 44 that by the 70s he would have to be licensed. If he was licensed, he'd have to pass examination in Russian. And again, I remind you that Jews did not speak Russian. Jews were speaking Yiddish. They wrote most of the ones who could write, and who wrote anything who could write Hebrew. Most of the population speak Yiddish. Now, the period of the 40s is after this thing is set up, the Haskalah moves towards a different direction now. Once the educational system is set up, Jews don't go to this. Schools are set up, money is spent, teachers are hired, very, very few Jews go. Many Jews are enrolled, they never attend. And so Haskalah now, this period, the men of the Haskalah who are estranged from the Jewish community and who have been looking to the government, who have the system set up by the government, now turned towards Hebrew culture. It's a unique type of phenomenon because what we recall in Germany, in Central Europe, the enlightened Jews started moving towards assimilation, started moving towards the secondary language of the state. Mendelssohn wrote and spoke better German than he did Hebrew. He spoke Jerusalem, it's written in German. But the opposite occurs in Russia. The men don't move towards Russia. They don't move towards Russia. They don't move towards the program of Russification. But the men of the Haskalah of the 40s and 50s now start moving towards Hebrew. They start writing Hebrew poetry. They start writing Hebrew novels. It's not modern Hebrew. It's not the type of Hebrew that one comes across now. It's a mixture of biblical Hebrew, the type of Hebrew found in the Talmud, with some new words based upon old roots. Very difficult to read, but it is some sort of secularization, beginnings of Hebrew culture. The only way I can explain it, I really don't know, the only way I can explain it is that the Jews, being in Russia, really were a nation within a nation. And the Jewish people, the masses, never moved in towards Russian culture at this time. And so what they did was they developed their own culture, what they came into with Russia. Again, you must realize that the problems of emancipation are not there because there's no thought of emancipation. The Russia of Nicholas I in the 40s and the 50s, especially after 48, is a very autocratic Russia. It's a Russia with still in serfdom. No judiciary, no independent judiciary, no real progressive school system. So the Jews did not move in to this type of system. They remained exclusive. The Jewish intellectuals, the non-religious intellectuals, the Maskilim, started moving in towards this Hebrew culture. We have a period of about 15 years, about 45, 46 to about 60, 61. There's a development of Hebrew culture within Russia. Of course, those people who start arguing about the roots of the Zionist movement in Russia, of course, will point to this type of culture, development of Hebrew culture, Hebrew language within Russia. By the 60s, by the 56 towards 60, we start moving into a new Russia. We have what's called in Russian history the era of the great reforms. Nicholas passes away in the middle of the Crimean War. His son, Alexander II, becomes the Tsar. There's a movement towards liberalization. As we know Russian history, we know the whole series of reforms. The Maskilim, the men of the Haskalah, were certain that Jewish emancipation would follow any day within the 60s. We're certain that the 60s, as it saw the emancipation of the serf, as it saw the institution of the local government set up, judiciary, independent judiciary set up, said what is left but emancipation of the Jews. So in the 60s, we do get a program and policy of Russification. This is borne out by a publication Hebrew journals and Russian journals. The very first journal published in Russia, a Jewish Oriental journal, was published in the Russian language, published in 1860. This journal could only go for a year, internal problems. Another one was published in 1861. But at the same time, there's a carryover from that Hebrew culture of the 40s and 50s, because when the government allowed Russian language journals to be published, at the same time gave permission for Hebrew language journals to be published. And we have a Hebrew language journal being published in 60. And there's a Hebrew language journal being published in 56, all the way back in 56, but it's published outside the Russian Empire for sale in the Empire, the problems of getting a permit to publish. And there's one published in Odessa in 60, another one in 61, in Vilna. And we have really two cultures going on here. We have this old Haskalah of emphasis of Hebrew and a new Russification policy among Jewish intellectuals starting roughly in 60, 61. Again, with the object being that if we learn the language, if we go to school, if we become Russians, we will be emancipated. The program is also characterized by 63. You recall the name Baron Gunzburg. The name was on the plaque of one of the rich Russian Jews. Gunzburg and several of the other rich Russian Jews, very similar to the Central European case, set up a committee called the Society for the Promotion of Culture Among Jews. The word in Hebrew for culture they used was Haskalah, the Society for Promotion of Haskalah among Jews, in which the objects were to publish as many books as possible into Russian. The Society, for the first time, authorized someone to translate the Bible into Russian, the Hebrew Bible into Russian. The Society started translating German into Russian. The idea was to move towards the Russian culture, to move towards knowledge of Russian among Jews. This aspect of Haskalah continues. But there are problems again. These problems are the problems of Russian history. In 1863, you must recall there was a Polish revolt. An outbreak of the Polish revolt is a very severe, very tough policy of Russification on the part of the government. So we have these two policies of Russification overlapping each other. The government is trying to Russify all non-Russians, and the Jewish Maskilim, radical Maskilim, are doing the same thing, trying to Russify. At the same time, there's another ingredient added. I'm sorry to be throwing these things so fast, but in 1863, out of nowhere, there's a Yiddish journal published. All of a sudden, again, published by a man who had formerly published a Hebrew journal, who was intending to publish a Russian journal. But again, the idea is mass education. And so he says, the only language the masses understand is Yiddish, so we must publish in Yiddish. Now, he ran into a lot of problems from his fellow Maskilim, so that Yiddish is a language. If you want to publish anything, publish in German with Hebrew script, which had been done before. So, why publish in Yiddish? It became a very, very popular journal because this is what people could read, what they could understand. The journal ran for about 7-8 years, until 79. And so we get this period of 63 to roughly 80, where we have quite a few currents moving within the Jewish community. We have radical assimilationists, radical Russificationists, who are trying to make the language of the Jewish community Russian. We have men carrying over from the old Haskalah movement who want to continue inside the Hebrew culture. In the mid-60s, you have a controversy, a conflict between the two of them. The only thing I want to draw from this idea of the Jewish community in Russia being pushed and pulled and dragged towards modernization. Because at the same time, the Russian policy of Russification for the entire country, at the same time with the Russian movement towards industrialization, the Jewish community for the first time is being moved. The Jewish community is starting to move into different patterns of life. The economic patterns of life are changing. The intellectual patterns of life are changing. And the social patterns of life are changing also. But again, I gave you statistics on education. In November 1853, was 1.25% of all the students in schools at the university level were Jews. By 1863, the number is 3.2%. This is just the beginning of this period of rapid Russification. By 1873, 10 years later, it's jumped 10%. 13.2% of all students are Jewish. But this is really the period of great movement, and there are many, many strings pushing, pulling on the Jewish community. And we have one aspect, one part of the Muscadine, where counting on the government for emancipation at any day. Counting on this, we are growing school, look at the numbers, counting on emancipation. Another group is saying that we have our own culture, that we have something of our own, and that we shouldn't assimilate, we shouldn't move into a different culture. So by 1881, when Alexander II is assassinated, and a series of pogroms break out in southern Russia after the assassination, we really have the Jewish community caught. Those Muscadines who counted on the government for everything were really at a point where they were rejected, because the government had turned on them, the government had protected them. And the Jews had been scapegoated, partially, for this assassination of Alexander II. What we do is then have these movements, again, towards assimilation, towards moving out of Russia, and movements away from North Russia. And only a couple minutes left, if there are any questions before the end. Okay, remember there's a lecture on Friday, and the examinations will be delivered in section.